You are listening to Intrepid Healthcare's exclusive coverage of the Gulf Coast Hymns Chapter's Fall Conference. Welcome to GC3 Hymns, direct from New Orleans, Louisiana. Our coverage is brought to you by Javion, changing healthcare one prediction at a time. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Schnick and Joe Lavelle.
All right, good morning and welcome back to the show. Todd and Joe live. We are at GC3 Hymns. That's where we are. We're having a great time, as you can tell. Bourbon Street maybe have gotten me as well. So, all right. Well, Joe, this is one of our favorite conversations with these two. We've had them on the show several times before, and so looking forward to our continued dialogue with these guys. So let's welcome back to the show Dr. John Showalter, who is the Chief Health Information Officer with the University of Mississippi Medical Center, and Lee Williams, the Director of Revenue Cycle and Health Information Management with UMMC. John, Lee, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back.
Thank you.
John, let's start off with you. Do a quick run through about you and your background.
Sure. I am an internal medicine physician. I'm also board certified in clinical informatics and mainly responsible for getting our return on our investment back from our EHR implementation at the university.
Outstanding. We remind the audience a bit about you and your background.
I am leader for the mid-cycle of revenue cycle at the university. I have responsibility for charge capture, coding, medical records, clinical documentation improvement, and I'm also over our ICD-10 implementation project.
Outstanding. Well, one of every two episodes on our show is about you, with you guys, and so our audience is probably pretty familiar with you, MMC, but why don't you, Dr. Showalter, why don't you remind the audience about you, MMC?
Sure. It is the state's only academic medical center. We have the only level one trauma center and the only high level NICU in the state. We serve an underserved population in Jackson, Mississippi, but our main purpose is to improve the health of the entire state.
Fantastic. Well, we've talked many times before about ICD-10, and maybe this time we can talk about the things you've done for ICD-10 in preparation that you actually found made things better overall, clinically and administratively. And one of the real points I love to hear you talk about, Dr. Showalter, is how physicians are really more prepared than they think for ICD-10. Maybe you could start with that line and tell us what you found as you began to talk about ICD-10 and improving documentation.
Certainly. There is a lot of apprehension about ICD-10, especially in the physician community. And if you go out and you read the lay press, you know, even last week, there's another posting of 12 ridiculous codes for Thanksgiving, or, you know, struck by turkey or something. And we've got off track on a whole number of codes that, yes, they do exist, but will they ever get used? We don't really know, but they're from a grouping of, in combination of categories that make sense when they go together. And physicians, for the most part, are prepared for writing the right words in the chart to make ICD-10 make sense. We've done a number of chart reviews. We've reviewed over 300 encounters, and even when we have them externally validated, physicians are 95, 96% of the way there. Most of our charts don't need any additional words to be ready for ICD-10. The physicians already say it's a right or left leg. They already say what bone's broken. They already say what the fracture was. And we've come up with very few things where the clinical nature of the procedure or the event and the actual ICD-9 code don't match very well. But for the most part, if you just do the job you're doing today, you can exist in ICD-10 as a physician with somewhere between 10 and 20 or 30 changes to your documentation.
Well, how have we failed to help doctors understand that, Lee? What can be done to get that message across, and why are we failing at that?
So I think that meaningful dialogues that help the physicians understand what exactly the changes are going to be is important. So for example, as part of our academic medical center outreach in the state, we've been doing some talks about ICD-10 with community providers in the Delta region of Mississippi. And many of these are solo practitioners who are cook, bottle washer, and coder for their own practices. And they come in with a lot of trepidation and anxiety around ICD-10. And throughout even a one-hour conversation, we give some real examples of what's going on. And when we take the entire code set and say, you know, this is like having a dictionary. You don't need to memorize every single word to effectively speak English. You only need the words that you're going to use on a regular basis. So we might hand out a single-page tip sheet and say, let's take a look at this for common internal medicine terminology changes from 9 to 10. And once they get those concrete examples, they realize that, oh, I already knew those things, like the right and left leg example that Dr. Showalter just gave. They see something that is meaningful to them clinically. They use that already. They didn't understand that that's what the gap was going to be. So having something where they can actually lay eyes on and hands on an example that is in their specialty, that is in their daily work, and seeing that it's not that big of a stretch to go from where they are today to tomorrow. I think that relieves a lot of the anxiety, and that's where the conversations need to be. I've not had any clinicians walking out that from those discussions that are anything but more prepared and more relaxed about the overall transition and now open to, okay, just tell me the stuff I got to do because I think I can manage this.
John, this idea of a doctor being more prepared for this than he or she realizes is not a theory of yours. This is based on surveys and conversations. This is real, yeah?
This is very real. And being prepared, I guess, doesn't make good headlines. And No one's going to read the article of, in ICD-10, doctors have to write right and left. You know, they're going to read the headline and they said, ICD-10 is going to double the codes. And that's the kind of headlines that we have. You know, I read this thing that said the orthopedics codes, there are 10 times as many codes as there were in ICD-9. And we say, yes, because you actually will code out what joint it was. And before this coded out to manual disruption of joint adhesions, and they go, wait, I wrote an entire paragraph and it got to this generic code because they're not even aware that that's what's occurring. So we've done the actual reviews. We've had at the university, we've had a third party company come in and review 250 encounters. So 5 days visits and H&Ps, somewhere around 2,000 documents have been reviewed by an external party. And they come through and they compare what changed between 9 and 10, and they validate our coding in 9, and we're doing a very good job coding in 9. And they come back and say, here's all the stuff that was fine and didn't need any changes. And out of those 200 documents, out of the 2,000 documents, maybe 200 have something that we could go back and change. And it's very frequently within a theme. So about half of our documents that had something that was wrong were based upon the new small bowel, the small intestines, because ICD-10 wants the portion of the small bowel. And from a surgical perspective, it's very hard to actually know, did I take out part of the first third or the second third or the last third? And we have different names for them, but they change on pathology. They don't change on physical gross appearance. So the surgeons don't know. We're going to have to figure out how we deal with that. But that's, you know, one problem we found in ICD-10, and we found 1,800 documents that don't need any additional information.
Talk to us maybe about some of the tools that made it easier. I know we've talked about big data and predictive analytics before. Maybe talk about the tools that you started with for ICD-10 and how you're now using them for more than ICD-10.
Okay, so, and one of the things I love about our tools is that most of these are homegrown. These are ideas that we had. We like 2-cent solutions. We don't want to have to go through big contracts or lots of money to get to where we're going. So we began very simply with doing chart reviews and working with the clinicians, bringing our coding staff and our health information management professionals up to speed on the ICD-10 requirements, in addition to other things like value-based purchasing and readmissions, other programs that are going on, so that we knew where we were trying to steer the physician with their efforts, and also to know which focus areas we had for each specialty, but then really just getting in and talking about where do we think we have room for improvement with the documentation, and then doing reviews, concurrent reviews, even leveraging the coders who are looking at the charts every single day already, just to have them comment where they need help with the current vocabulary, and then creating a feedback mechanism to the doctors. So even if you just leverage your existing coding staff, your existing physician feedback mechanism, or creating something that is simple in this process, begins that dialogue of where we need to have different or better or more language, or even sometimes where it needs to be in the chart. So we found things where we could straighten stuff up about, you've put this in the op report, but we need it in a progress note or in a discharge summary, etc. So just leveraging the existing methodologies and the existing processes to have an ICD-10 and a data perspective, so that you're harvesting out of it what you need.
Did I hear you correctly that you, in essence, created your own tools?
For documentation improvement, yes. So we have a documentation excellence program that we run throughout the university that is projects that we've centered around. We're an academic medical center, so we have them with each of our 17 academic departments. Another way to think about that is doing it by service line or by specialty. And we focus in there with just bringing simple data, which unspecified codes you're using, so you can get that out of your claims data and just say, which unspecified codes did you use last month? We look at where the coders are sending queries, where we have CDI specialists. We do have a CDI program with nurses. What type of queries are they asking? And using those existing pieces of information to say, okay, this is the one we need to focus on getting this right, because not only is it important for ICD-10, it's important for today, or we're touching on something that also counts in value-based purchasing, and just being smart and understanding what they're working with today and using those with the mind and the goal of moving them towards compliance with ICD-10, but also preparedness for the overall CMS pay-for-performance shift.
No, but it's brilliant. The point I wanted to make, though, and emphasize, is that you took the initiative on that, and I worry that too many providers don't have the wherewithal to know that they can do that, or do they have the right kind of personnel in their IT department to make that happen? I mean, how do you overcome that challenge?
So I think one of the ways that we overcame that challenge is that Lee and I had put together a data-driven maturity model that kind of building off the HIMSS analytics, you know, adoption kind of model. You know, you scale from zero to five, and it's about one of the criteria, are you meeting with the physicians? And if you're not meeting with them, you have a zero. And if you have routine scheduled meetings for the next 12 months, you're a five. Are you bringing actionable data? And if you're bringing no data, it's zero. If you're bringing spreadsheets, it's a one. If you're actually bringing detailed analysis with actionable knowledge, you get a five. And what we realized when we scored ourselves against that is that at best anywhere, we were a two. So even though we thought we were reasonably good at this, when we actually broke it down, we were at a two, which means I know that a lot of places are at a zero.
Mm-hmm.
And
if you were at a two.
And if you can't, if you're not actually meeting with people, sharing actionable knowledge and educating, there is no way to move any of these processes forward. Whereas if you have regularly scheduled meetings with actionable knowledge and education, you're clearly going to move forward. There's no way really not to. And people aren't going to just sit around and be bad for the institution. That's just not, at least I don't think people are made up that way.
No, and key really is, so Dr. Showalter said actionable knowledge. That's where you leverage your health information management professionals, your CDI specialists, your coders, your information systems people to pull the data, do that analysis, and then present it back to the physicians in a way that makes sense to them as clinicians. So if you just say ICD-10 and you talk numbers, that's not meaningful to them. Some of them don't even ever look at the numbers. Some of them do, and they've got their beloved numbers that they memorized 10 years ago. But we really take it away from the code set and the numbers and drive more towards what language they need in there. So we'll talk about having, for example, within neurosurgery, we had some work to do on coma and getting that appropriately described. But when we presented that to the clinician and said, hey, we've got to get to where we're using these three terms instead of this one vague term, he was baffled that anybody would ever have put a vague term and just needed to know that that was out there. So you're shedding light for your physician leadership on what everyone is doing in their documentation and helping them see where they need to make those improvements and condensing it down into something where in 1 hour you can have a conversation around your top priorities and give them very specific tasks to do that fit with what they do anyway. They already document. They already communicate between providers. Give them the things that they need to be talking about rather than just saying there's a new chapter for ICD-10 for your group. They don't do anything with that. You have to give them something that's very specific to them in their way of thinking about it they can go out and use.
And I think that actual knowledge piece is very important and is missing in this ICD-10 conversation. We are telling physicians that your codes are going to go up three times. What we're not saying is I need you to document whether it's the beginning, the middle, or the end of the bone. Yeah. And the reason that the codes are going up three times is that almost all of your bones have a beginning, middle, and end, and you have to document that. If you go to a surgeon and say, I need you to document, you know, the beginning, middle, or the end of the bone, they go, oh, okay, I can do right. That. They may or may not make the behavior change, but it's not scary or something they really fight.
You guys are speaking or presenting here at CG3 HIMSS, and I know everybody's excited about that. The title of your presentation, Technology, HIM, and Physicians, a Partnership that Drives Value. Tell us one or two of the key points that you're going to drive home for those that aren't going to be able to attend that session.
The number one key that I'm going to drive home is that if we're going to make the gains of the health system that we need the technology expertise, the physician expertise, and the HIM expertise working on the process improvements and the workflows together. We all have a little piece of a very large problem getting from what I write down and how I write it down in a system to getting paid accurately and doing this smoothly and then getting judged in value-based purchasing based upon what I wrote down is a completely different world than we were in 15 years ago. And all three have to be together to drive that. And when they all get to the table, there really are amazing results. I mean, our results are all in the millions for each project thus far.
Wow.
Well, it saddens me, Joe, that they have to deliver this presentation. It just seems to me that this ought to be the way things ought to be, right? I mean, why is that not happening? Is it just never been done that way? Are there been warring factions? I mean, why is that not happening naturally?
I think that perhaps in the past, groups were used to working more independently, and the EHR makes a huge difference. So today, when you bring in technology, it is all of a sudden the backbone of all of the communications, and you've got your HIM professionals who are working in there, you've got your physicians who are working in there, and then information systems really working to provide all of that in a way that gives the tools that we need for running the systems. And it brings it together where perhaps before you could have a coder talk to a physician about a change that needs to be made in the documentation, and they would take their pen and write that on a piece of paper that then got filed in a record. Today, that means that we think about things like structured templates in the EHR, and you want to bring that analyst in to say, how can you help us make this workflow more efficient? We also have a lot more tools than before, so one of the things that we'll talk about is some screen sharing technology that we've leveraged to make HIM professionals available to physicians anywhere, anytime, because we can log in and get right onto their screen, even if they're 50 miles away in a remote clinic. So technology like that that exists now that is designed to create better workflows and to create communications that are real-time, video conferencing. There's lots of ideas like that where things that didn't exist even 5 years ago now are routine tools that we have. And it's thinking about how can I take something and use it in a new, innovative way to achieve the goal that I want, and just having people that are willing to be a little crazy and think, you know, our help desk in information systems uses the screen sharing technology, and that's working really well for them, but they don't have the skill set to answer the questions about the medical record. Why don't we get those medical records people to use that technology to provide that service? It was just taking building blocks we had and connecting them in a different way and getting a result that was really beneficial for all of us. So maybe just now is the time that we've got available technology, people are better educated on these things, and we're being forced to work together because of the way the systems are integrated around that electronic health record.
And I think one of the problems is, you know what you see, right? So as a physician in the paper world, you know, what we mainly knew about medical records is that there was somebody that I brought a chart to, or that brought me a chart, and that was my interaction with them. So, you know, with the prejudice that come from that kind of knowledge, you know, how helpful could the person that hands me a chart really be? Well, actually, you know, they have a master's degree in understanding physician documentation and translating it into the code that gets us paid. I can tell you, I came out of medical school with the chip on my shoulder about this and got put on a group working with the HIM professionals and made all the stupid comments that doctors make about HIM professionals. And
hey, now.
They make a lot of stupid comments about HIM professionals. They're not true. We just make them. And really found out what they did and became amazingly impressed with the knowledge and what they were doing. And in this world of value, and that value is based upon administrative data, they are immensely important in making sure that we do things right on the front end so that we get judged correctly on the back end and paid correctly on the back end. And it's a partnership that I don't think exists well in many places. I think we get looked at a little odd that the Director of Revenue Cycle and the CHIO are as tied together as we are, but we wouldn't have the gains unless both of our groups are working together.
We've established that you guys have really approached ICD-10 with a really smart approach and direction. For those out there listening that aren't sure what to do, tell us what your approach is, given the uncertainty, so you know you're going to be ready, yet you know you got to balance that with all the other priorities for money and resources.
Yeah, and first and foremost, you have to have the nuts and bolts done. You're going to have to make sure that you can send and receive the codes. We've had years to do that. Hopefully your vendors are there, or that you're using an intermediary that's there. But that's just got to be done. After that, it's really about spending the time, and it's not going to be months or years. I mean, it's going to be a couple hours of spending the time to find out, how does ICD-10 affect my practice? How does ICD-10 affect the 20 codes that reflect 90% of my visits? Which payer do I really need to make sure that I work things out with, because there's 50% of my reimbursement? It's all going to be about prioritizing, and the code set's going to evolve and going to change, and we're going to need to evolve and change. ICD-9 does not look like ICD-9 from 1982. ICD-10 is going to change as well, and we're going to have to keep up and learn more about it. But learn what you need to do, make it manageable, and knowing your top 10 codes is better than knowing no codes.
I agree with that. And when we talk with the practitioners who are not tied to an institution, who are very, very well prepared. So the folks that are struggling for some direction, it really is so block and tackle, contact your vendors. Some of them have said to me, well, the vendor has on their website that they'll be ready by April. I've encouraged them to reach out and have a dialogue and just say, walk me through your plan. What do I need to do? What do you need to do? And you can delegate that to someone. Or if you are the cook and bottle washer, then make that phone call. Take one day, 1 hour, and make some phone calls and tell them. It's really their burden. They're your vendors. Ask them to demonstrate to you how their preparedness is going to be and how you're going to do the testing. Figure out within your state what the claims testing opportunities are and make sure that you're getting signed up or throwing your name in the hat to be able to partake in those. And then buckle down and figure out what's most important to your practice. So I recommend they identify who pays your bills. So if you stopped getting money, and where would it matter? So the payer that gives you 1% of your reimbursement, if you fall down with them, that's not that big of a deal. But your payer that gives you 60% of your monthly income, you need to have a plan with them. So really think about which of those payers matter and focus your efforts on those. And then within your practice, figure out which services are the ones that are driving your business and focus your attention on those. And I've seen even on the faces of some of those practitioners a little bit of relaxing when they had specific stuff like that to do. I need to call a vendor. I need to figure out who my income's coming from, and I need to figure out which services I have got to get right in the system and do that. And then if you have more time, do more. But if that's all you get done, you'll still be viable as a business in October of 2015. So that at least is a starting point for where you can get prepared.
Yeah, and if I could issue one challenge to the physicians, every physician out there either has a preference list or a fee sheet or something that's got the tick boxes of the 10 codes that they normally use. Take that list of 10 ICD-9 codes, go on to Google or get the app that does the gem mapping and type that ICD-9 code in and see what those ICD-10 codes that map out to you. Mm-hmm. 9 out of 10 people that do that are going to go, wow, that actually makes sense. I understand what's going on. I can handle that. This is not such a big deal. And it's going to take you 5 minutes to do. You know, so before we publish the next Hit by Turkey cartoon, go out there and find out how ICD-10 is actually going to affect your practice and come with a more informed opinion.
Gosh, Dr. Showalter, how many times in life do we dread a task and think it's going to be this horrible, overly complicated task, and we sit down and do it, it's actually quite simple. I mean, that's exactly what it sounds like you're saying.
I love your challenge. Let's have them do it before the Hit by Reindeer posts come out.
All right. Well, John and Lee, sadly, we're running low on time. Before we let you go, how can people get in touch with you, and where can they learn more about the work you're doing at UMMC?
So the easiest place to find me is either on LinkedIn or on Twitter. And Twitter, it's at John Showalter, MD.
And that's the same for me. So LinkedIn and Twitter is at LeighTW, so at LeighTW.
All right. Lee Williams, the Director of Revenue Cycle and Health Information Management, and Dr. John Showalter, Chief Health Information Officer with UMMC, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. Guys, as always, great to have you. Thanks again for stopping by and joining us.
Thanks
for having us.
All right. Well, that wraps this conversation. On behalf of our guests, Dr. John Showalter and Lee Williams, my co-host Joe Lavelle, I'm Todd Schnick. We'll see you soon on Intrepid Healthcare.